This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. Panic is old hat on Wall Street, wrote James Grant in the Washington Post on Sunday, March 16th. Rarely before, however, has there been a crisis so comprehensive as this one. What is James Grant referring to? On Friday, March 14th, invoking a little-used provision that had been added to the Federal Reserve Act in 1932 at the height of the Great Depression, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York decided to infuse credit to Bear Stearns. But because Bear Stearns is not a depository bank of the Federal Reserve, the money was going to go through J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase, a mammoth $1.6 trillion bank that operates in more than 60 countries. Under the terms of this, quote, secured loan facility, the Federal Reserve would be able to extend credit for up to 28 days instead of overnight credit as usual. The risk of a default by Bear Stearns would be borne by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, not by J.P. Morgan Chase. In other words, J.P. Morgan Chase, the mammoth banking institution, was only going to be a conduit for cash provided by the U.S. Central Bank. How unusual. And why was this taking place? Bear Stearns, founded in 1923 with the first escalation of Wall Street, 15,500 employees, $300 billion on its balance sheet, the fifth largest investment bank in the United States, the second largest underwriter of mortgage bonds. Here we have Bear Stearns with its imposing Madison Avenue headquarters, which in itself is worth between $800 million and $1 billion. Bear Stearns, this mammoth investment bank, a stalwart of the financial institutions of the United States, couldn't make its bills, couldn't meet its credit obligations. Bear Stearns, an incredible crisis, and crisis hitting the entire financial institutions of the United States. No longer mortgage crisis with the subprime mortgage lenders like Countrywide failing and being taken over by larger banks such as Bank of America. As Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve chief, wrote in the Financial Times, March 16th, the current financial crisis in the United States is likely to be judged in retrospect as the most wrenching since the end of the Second World War. Greenspan is hopeful. He says that when home prices stabilize and the value of equity in homes supporting troubled mortgage securities stabilizes, then there will be a resurgent economy. Will that happen? Have the chinks in the capitalist structure finally opened wide enough where the federal government cannot step in? As one of the economists said, you have socialization of risk and privatization of gain. Today on Taking Aim, we will discuss in more detail the collapse of Bear Stearns and what it means. That is, what is the crisis of fictive capital? Ralph?
Well, Maya, for those of our listeners, brothers and sisters, who have been paying attention to what we have been trying to say over a space of 7 years, we have attempted to show and to discuss the abiding crisis of capitalism as an economic and political and social order. Because long ago, capitalism had ceased to be capable of advancing what are called productive forces in society. Long ago, capitalism had become dependent upon deficit financing, upon waste production such as the addiction to arms, upon constant speculation on pieces of paper against which monies are lent that bear no resemblance to the actual collateral that is sustaining those loans, with speculation upon speculation, what is called fictive capital, a house of cards waiting for its collapse. Here now we have the abiding analysis of socialists and of Marxists sustained by the actual mouthpieces of capital in all their main organs, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian of London, the London Times, the U.S. News and World Report, Fortune Magazine, Business Week, all sustaining a critique that is essentially one of Marxism without the name.
And, Ralph, when we have the collapse of Bear Stearns and the intervention of the federal government that was announced on Friday, that wasn't sufficient. The Federal Reserve, despite dramatic actions on multiple fronts to avert a crisis of what it considered was going to be a crisis of the global financial system, decided that it wasn't sufficient to just fund Bear Stearns to supply the credit that to let it meet its obligations. And over the weekend, there were marathon negotiations in New York and Washington, and a decision was made that J.P. Morgan Chase, the major Wall Street bank, would buy Bear Stearns for a bargain basement price. That is paying $2 a share for an institution that plays a central role in executing financial transactions. Now, this was 3.5% of what the Bear Stearns stock had been on Thursday before this decision was made, but it was only 2.5% of the value of what Bear Stearns was on Valentine's Day in February.
98% of the value of one of the most important financial and speculative and mortgage, and stock brokering institutions of capitalist society, 98% of its value disappearing overnight, handed over to J.P. Morgan Chase, the 14,000 employees of Bear Stearns who were investors in Bear Stearns, losing everything that they have. As classic with capitalism, a Bear Stearns market, says James Grant. Panic is old hat on Wall Street, he begins his analysis. However, rarely has there been a crisis so comprehensive as this one. Has he merely engaged in rhetoric? He continues, it first materialized last summer in the shape of a disturbance in the low-rated or subprime mortgage market. Contained, the regulatory establishment hopefully pronounced, but in fact it has blazed across markets and time zones with central bankers, politicians, and treasury functionaries in hot and futile pursuit, he writes. What makes these proceedings so frightening is that not only is credit in crisis, but so too is money. The well-founded doubts about the promises to pay money and the nature and integrity of the dollar at stake are in question. And so on Friday, the Federal Reserve committed to lend undisclosed billions to bail out Bear Stearns, a top Wall Street purveyor of mortgage-backed securities and the leading lender to hedge funds. But where will, James Grant writes in the Washington Post, where will the Fed find these dollars? Where it always does. It has to print them. Despite, he writes, the abundant evidence from the currency and gold markets that the world has about all the dollar bills it cares to hold. In short, the dollar is virtually worthless. The dollar is without standing. The dollar is compromised by deficit. The dollar bears no relation to real value. It is an artificial construct today, brothers and sisters, and the global economy is predicated upon a phantom.
Ralph, J.P. Morgan Chase, this major institution, $1.5 trillion of assets operating in more than 60 countries, J.P. Morgan Chase didn't become this behemoth by making stupid investment decisions. It was going to get this venerable, also venerable institution, Bear Stearns. But J.P. Morgan Chase said, hey, federal government, Federal Reserve, we don't want to take on the risk of the speculative investments. So the Federal Reserve said, J.P. Morgan Chase, do us a favor. You'll take over all the great assets of Bear Stearns, and we will take on the risk of the $30 billion worth of the speculative mortgage-backed investments.
In short, it's what David Stockman, the Secretary of Commerce of Ronald Reagan, once called so succinctly the corporate soup line. The same corporate soup line that sees the federal government subsidizing all the major sectors of capitalist industry in the United States. Not only are they not paying taxes, but they receive outright government subsidies, which are virtual looting of the treasury. And then the analysis with respect to Bear Stearns by the financial analyst of the Washington Post, James Grant. By the look of things, he writes, America's surfeited creditors must make room for many billions more. It says, the markets are in uncharted waters. Robert Rubin, chairman of the Citigroup Executive Committee, and by the way, Citigroup itself is on the verge of collapse, urged the government to exert itself on behalf of the mortgage market. And Grant writes, who are these bankers who went sailing off the end of the earth and thereby find it necessary to pass the cup to the government? The company of errant, lavishly compensated navigators includes none other than Robert Rubin himself. Now, Robert Rubin is not only chairman of the Citigroup Executive Committee, he was Bill Clinton's, what was he, Secretary of Treasury or Secretary of Commerce, Maya?
Treasury.
Last fall, the former Treasury Secretary confessed to Fortune magazine, Grant writes, that until the mortgage storms broke over his head in the summer of 2007, he was, quote, unfamiliar with the complex mortgage structures with which Citigroup's own balance sheet was packed. Almost certainly, the gulf between competence and compensation on Wall Street has never been wider, writes James Grant. These are fraudulent individuals with the color of authority presiding over a house of cards, enriching themselves and their cronies in the process, and abundantly incompetent and indifferent to the consequences. These lapses in mortgage underwriting are justly called, Grant stated, the greatest failure of ratings and risk management ever, unquote. Mortgages are far from the only blighted department of credit. The same carefree lending standards that led to record high home foreclosures has brought deepening troubles in the market for loans to highly indebted companies. The no-document, interest-only, no-money-down mortgage is a kind of universal American business model. In other words, hand them the cash, milk the public, stick the homeowner, and hand out the cash to the speculators, the executives, the captains of capital. What does Grant state? It wouldn't be so bad if the United States were not the issuer of the world's reserve currency. The dollar is not only America's script, it is the store of value and the medium of exchange in Asia, South America, and the Middle East. And yet here's the rub. The Federal Reserve makes monetary policy for one country only. This is a critique which is devastating in its implications. He ends this article, and it's a long article. It is a pickle for the ages, not one without its compensations. The falling prices in Wall Street are beginning to restore a semblance of value to stocks and bonds, but the plunging dollar prompts a serious reexamination of worldwide monetary arrangements, which is a polite way of saying the system is in terminal decay.
Ralph, it's interesting how quickly this is all escalating. The subprime crisis began 1 year ago, and it is 2 weeks ago, February 27th, that Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, appeared before the Financial Services Committee of the House of Representatives, and this is before the Senate Banking Committee. And this was to deliver the Federal Reserve semi-annual report to Congress. He believed at the time, he said, that the U.S. could avert a recession. Now, he said this, Bernanke said this, but the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Financial Times, everyone says the U.S. is headed into a deep recession. So I don't know where Bernanke gets his analysis from. But even though he said there wouldn't be a recession and there wouldn't be a crisis, he painted a grim picture of the economy that's reeling from a housing collapse, a credit and banking collapse, a slowdown in consumer spending, growing unemployment, 63,000 announced as being employed in the last report. This is just in a monthly report. There are hundreds of thousands who are filing unemployment. There's virtually zero economic growth by capitalist standards of measuring growth. And there's accelerating inflation, a weakening dollar, and as everyone can see, the basket of goods, the consumer basket of goods, what we purchase, the prices are going up. And that's what they mean by inflation. It costs more to live. Just look at the price of oil, from $20 a barrel to over $100 a barrel. So he said this on February 27th. What was the reaction of President Bush and the Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson? On February 28th, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who was then seconded by President Bush at his Thursday press conference, February 28th, they rejected all proposals that were being worked out between the Wall Street banks and the Congress, the Democratic Party-led Congress, for a government-funded bailout of mortgage lenders, banks, and financial institutions that were holding tens of billions of dollars in bad investments linked to these subprime and other shaky mortgages. So 2 weeks ago, the government was saying, we will not step in. 2 weeks later, not only is there a massive bailout of Bear Stearns, it is announced that there's a massive bailout of all these banking institutions. Ralph?
Maya, once again, let's return to the financial pundits of the capitalist press. Here's the International Herald Tribune on March 11th, and Reuters correspondent James Saft is the analyst. In the United States, the economy and banking are pushing each other downhill, is the headline. Should we be more worried about the new crisis coming to a head in the financial system? Or that the United States is self-evidently in recession? Sadly, we don't have to choose. Banks starved of capital are calling in their debts, turning clients, notably hedge funds, into forced sellers, as large swathes of the financial markets are caught in a vicious cycle of margin calls, fire sales, and further price collapses. The United States Federal Reserve has tried to break the cycle again by offering an additional $200 billion to the banks on easier terms and for longer, but confidence in its ability to succeed has fallen. Meanwhile, in the real world, he writes, consumers and company managers have gotten the message and are firing each other as providers of goods and services and well-earning, wage-earning employees. The payroll data of the United States is grim indeed. Their retail and consumption figures are hardly encouraging. The Fed's effort to isolate the effects of the financial crunch from the real economy have clearly failed, said Lena Komaleva, an economist at the brokerage firm Tulet Prebon in London. We are now seeing the materialization of this new relationship between the financial and the real economy, where both are now in profound crisis, unquote. In essence, Saft writes, the negative feedback loop that the Fed fears with banking and the economy pushing one another downhill has taken hold. Payrolls fell by 63,000 in February, falling for the second consecutive month, the most in over 5 years. Banks have become even more unwilling to take risks with capital. They are asking borrowers to post more collateral against loans, even when these loans are used to finance the investment in supposedly safe instruments like treasury securities or mortgage bonds backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And what he writes in this extraordinary acknowledgement of the crisis, he says, prices for corporate debt and mortgages are at levels that imply a depression, not just a recession. There is no good reason to expect these prices to improve in the near term. Whether or not you are of the view that 1929 is at hand, and he writes, the banks will get some of the $1 trillion, but not most, meaning that mortgage debt and housing have a lot further to fall. The impact of all this on the economy and the impact of this economic downturn will result on the banks, which is, in a word, scary, unquote.
Ralph, I want to go to I want to go in more detail into something you were mentioning about the Federal Reserve loaning up to $200 billion to the investment banks. These are the Wall Street investment banks, not necessarily depository banks such as Bank of America or Citigroup or J.P. Morgan Chase, which are the traditional banks.
Mm-hmm.
And this $200 billion is among its $700 billion stash of treasury bonds. And what it's going to do with this $200 billion is, in effect, it's going to vouch for the credit worthiness of mortgage-backed assets. That is the compilation of mortgages that these mortgage companies and investment banks pool together. And then they use that as an instrument for trading. And they're going to vouch for this the credit worthiness of these mortgage-backed assets that don't really have much market value. In other words, nobody wants them because many of the mortgages that are pooled together, they've been foreclosed, these houses, and the mortgages don't have value. There's a collapse in the U.S. home sales and prices. There's almost a million homes that are vacant, or new homes plus homes that to be resold, you know, that have been occupied before. And these mortgage securities would have been written off as losses by the finance houses. So instead of their having to write off losses, which they've been doing for the past year, over almost $100 billion of losses among the many banks, both U.S. and international, instead of writing them off as losses, the Fed is coming in and propping them up and saying, you don't have to write them up as losses. We'll back them with $200 billion. And this is the first time this is actually taking place. It's the most massive debt relief plan for Wall Street that has ever been instituted. And as you say, it really reveals a very deep crisis of capitalism.
Well, Maya, the analysts of the capitalist press are extremely clear about this. The headline in the New York Times on March 14th, Economy Hammered by Toxic Blend of Ailments, by Vikas Bajaj. Everything is going wrong for the American economy at once. People are buying less. Most things are costing more. Mortgage rates are rising. The dollar is falling. Prices of key commodities like oil are leaping from one record high to the next. On Thursday, the dollar plumbed to new lows against the Japanese yen and other major currencies. The price of an ounce of gold jumped above $1,000 for the first time, and lenders have raised home loan rates once again. Government figures show retail sales fell in February. Consumers are cutting back on cars, furniture, electronics. Stocks have fallen sharply after the retail sales report. A large investment fund says it is nearing collapse. The volatility that has defined the market continues unabated. A toxic blend of economic and financial developments is testing policymakers and lawmakers who are struggling to contain a slump brought on by the collapse of the mortgage market, a downturn that is sure to push the economy into deep recession. Current conditions are a far cry from 1970s. Resurgent inflation is raising the threat of stagflation, a condition in which unemployment and the price of goods and services both rise. And he continues, the credit markets began to seize up in August, and the steps taken by the Federal Reserve and the rest of the federal government bolster stocks briefly, but have done little to stem the larger downward drift. And he continues, the stocks and bonds will decline. The dollar will keep falling until the weaker exchange rate increases American exports. And then he says the following. The fall of the dollar has contributed to the surge in commodity prices, oil, foodstuffs, and many other raw materials priced in dollars. And as the currency falls in value, suppliers of these commodities demand higher prices just to keep pace, just to stay even. The weakness of the dollar explains why oil prices jumped $23 a barrel in 6 weeks alone. Oil futures touched $111 a barrel for the first time and settled at $110 on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Gold prices surged past $1,000 a troy ounce. Where do we go? Said John Kilduff, Senior Vice President for Energy and MF Global in New York. Where can investors go? They are fleeing the dollar. They are seeking out hard assets like commodities, and it's pushing up oil prices. This is an abiding, self-perpetuating crisis, brothers and sisters. The analyst in the New York Times writes, we are nearing levels where it is not a great thing for the dollar to keep weakening, said David Gilmore, the partner at Foreign Exchange Analytics in Essex, Connecticut. And yet, the Fed is doing precisely that. By bailing out the banks, by slicing interest rates, they are weakening the dollar even more and exacerbating the rise in commodity prices and the inability of the people of the United States to afford food, to afford housing, to afford fuel oil, to afford gasoline, to afford to live. This is a deep, continuing, structural, abiding crisis as the house of cards of fictive capital is in a rapid process of collapse.
And the financial journals, such as the Wall Street Journal, understand this. Commenting on the discussions that took place between the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, the other Fed governors, and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Undersecretary Robert Steele that took place over the weekend before the decision to bail out Bear Stearns. They had made that decision, but then the decision that J.P. Morgan Chase would actually buy Bear Stearns, with President Bush complimenting Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson for working over the weekend. The Wall Street Journal noted, quote, if they allowed Bear to fail, the rest of Wall Street could have been dragged down with it. A major financial institution would have gone from being worth $8 billion to worthless overnight. And this would have created a freeze on lending. In other words, the banks and the financial institutions wouldn't have been able to borrow money because they make investments on only a margin. It's not that they have the full collateral to support what is their further lending and borrowing and to meet their obligations. So the other Wall Street banks also would have gone under, and they were anticipating that there would be a stock market collapse of what took place in 1987 at the time of the junk bond and insider trading collapse, and that led to what they Wall Street Journal says is untold damage to the U.S. economy. Other people said that the crash would have been as large as 1929. So you had many discussion as to why it was imperative for the federal government to step in and prop up the capitalist institutions. Bear Stearns, according to the New York Times, in writing last year, Bear Stearns had on its books $46 billion worth of mortgages and mortgage-backed and asset-backed securities. Its annual report stated that $29 billion worth of these assets were valued using computer models that had been derived from or supported from some kind of observable market data. So, in other words, the value of these securities is only based upon some computer model, not upon any real value. The value of the remaining $17 billion of the $46 billion was based on estimates from, quote, internally developed models or methodologies utilizing significant inputs that are generally less readily observable, end quote. In other words, someone's making it up. Some economist in the back room of Bear Stearns, some financial analyst, is saying if we put in, if we make this supposition and we make that supposition based upon some data that we have gathered from the different reporting institutions, such as the U.S. Census Bureau or the economic data that's released each month by the government, we put these into some sort of model, we are going to get a value for these securities. It's completely made up. And that's one of the things that Alan Greenspan addresses. There is no accurate way to develop an econometric model that is going to not fail at one point or another. Ralph?
Well, Maya, let's just continue to look at the way the financial pundits of the mainstream media have looked at this themselves. Here is Charles Wyplos in the Financial Times. The Fed is delaying the day of reckoning. In 1971, with the greenback weak and falling, U.S. Treasury Secretary John Connolly famously told the rest of the world, "The United States dollar is our currency and your problem." 30 years later, with the dollar strong and rising, Robert Rubin, his successor under Clinton, said no less famously, "A strong dollar is in the interest of the United States." I'm going to pause here, Maya, for station ID, and then we're going to continue with the Financial Times examination of the crisis of fictive capital.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital.
Charles Wyplos in the Financial Times. Glorifying a strong dollar when it is so weak means they do not care. It is Connolly without compassion, he writes. Jean-Claude Trichet, president of the European Central Bank, is thereby left bemoaning the excessive exchange rate moves. The economic conditions, says the Financial Times, surely call for medicine. If Mr. Trichet thinks the U.S. Federal Reserve is overreacting, he has a point. But the speed and scope of monetary easing by the Fed is unheard of. More worrisome is that it is not the right medicine. One ill is the bursting of the housing bubble, which is the consequence of the subprime folly of past years. Driving the interest rate to the floor will not solve the problem. Another ill is the continuing difficulty faced by banks as a consequence of their reckless lending and poor investment judgment. The rebound of anxiety amply demonstrates that massive easing of monetary policy is not working. The Fed is delaying the day of reckoning and in the process exporting the U.S. crisis, adopting policies that intentionally or not further weaken the dollar and further expand the global crisis.
Ralph, let's look into a little detail here as to how this evolved. And also, let's talk about what some of these institutions are. Because bandied about are names such as hedge fund. And most people don't understand what a hedge fund is. And frankly, I had to do a lot of research to really understand what they were talking about. Because we know the expression to hedge our bets. And in effect, that is one of the purposes for a hedge fund. That's how it got its name. But in fact, a hedge fund is a collection of wealthy individuals and institutions. It's a partnership. And it is it has aggressive investment strategies unavailable to regulated investment financial institutions such as banks, mutual funds. And it is consequently these hedge funds, and it's the government that allows these hedge funds to exist. It's the government that says hedge funds are exempt from the rules and regulations governing these publicly monitored institutions by the SEC, such as mutual funds or the FDIC, the Federal Depository Investment Insurance Company, which monitors banks. And it allows them to use aggressive techniques to make up all sorts of techniques such as derivatives or swapping or program trading or leveraging their money to great extents. What's happening now is that these hedge funds are approximately 30% of all fixed income security transactions in the United States, 55% of the derivatives with investment grade ratings, 55% of the trading volume of bonds that are bonds for emerging markets, and 30% of all equity trades. They are major part of the financial institutions in the United States. And it is not just wealthy people who have investments over $1 million who are involved in these hedge funds. We get the pension funds and other institutional investors involved in these funds. And we get in the venerable institutions such as Bear Stearns, Citigroup, all the banks, developing hedge funds. And it's these hedge funds, some of them, that were collapsing as they had major investments in the subprime market.
Well, Maya, when you hedge something, you put down a fraction of the actual investment you want to make. You put down 5%. You put down a nickel on the dollar. And for your nickel hedge, you get a dollar's value of speculative paper, which then becomes something against which further speculative investment is made. A derivative is made of the hedge fund speculative paper. Something is derived from something that has already been extrapolated from minimal core value. And the house of cards is built upon and built upon and built upon and speculation upon speculation, and it's traded and shuffled and pieces of paper are handed about with a fictive value. And dollars are handed around as if it's confetti paper. And fortunes are made overnight, but it's based upon nothing. It's based upon an inevitable collapse. Here is the Wall Street Journal on March 17th analyzing this very process. "The buck stops where?" is the headline. "In the credit market panic that it began in August, we have now reached a point of maximum danger. The global run on the dollar will become a rout. As the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee prepares to meet tomorrow, this should be its major concern. The Fed's main achievement has been to stir a global lack of confidence in the greenback. By every available indicator, investors are now fleeing the dollar for other currencies, seeking traditional safe havens as gold and commodities, oil surging to $110 a barrel, up from $70 as recently as September, gold above $1,000 an ounce, up from $700 in September. Speculators, this is the Wall Street Journal, speculator adding to this commodity boom, betting that the Fed has thrown price stability to the wind in order to ease the U.S. credit woes. The problem is that the dollar weakness is making all these problems worse. The flight from the dollar has made U.S.-based investments less attractive when the U.S. financial system urgently needs to raise capital. And the commodity boom is translating into higher food and energy prices that are robbing American consumers of their income. In the name of avoiding a recession, a reckless monetary policy has made one more likely." And here's how the Wall Street Journal concludes. "What the U.S. and world economy do not need is a Fed that continues to insist that inflation expectations are, quote, well anchored, unquote, when everyone else knows they are not. The Fed must restore some kind of monetary credibility, or today's panic will become tomorrow's crash," quote unquote, the Wall Street Journal, "The Buck Stops Where," March 17th, 2008.
Ralph, the best reporting I found was done by the BBC in explaining and really going into the details of what is emerging in this fictive capital crisis of capitalism. And one of the articles in the BBC is the U.S. subprime crisis in graphics. And they talk about the model, the banking model, where, as I mentioned before, mortgages are pooled together and then they sell this collection of mortgages that have been prepared by various mortgage institutions, such as bank or mortgage companies, and they sell it on the bond market and then it is traded. And this makes it easier for the institutions to then borrow more money because they've gathered the mortgage, but then they sell it off. In other words, they're not holding it. The mortgage bond market is now worth $6 trillion and is the largest single part of the $27 trillion U.S. bond market, and it's even bigger than the trading in Treasury bonds. The estimate by the brokerage firm Friedman, Billings, and Ramsey is that there is $11 trillion, rather than what the BBC says of $6 trillion, in U.S. mortgage debt. But it's backed by only $590 billion in capital, or you can say 19 parts of debt to one part equity. This is not tenable, the brokerage firm says. And that's why you're going to get collapse as people cannot meet their mortgages. Cleveland was considered the subprime capital of America. It's a working-class city. It's been hard hit by the decline of manufacturing, and it's sharply divided along racial lines. People were able to get cash by refinancing their homes, and often they were refinanced, and they were given loans without having collateral and without making down payments. And this type of loan was an adjustable-rate mortgage, called an ARM. The payments were fixed for 2 years, and then they would become higher and dependent upon the Fed interest rates. Well, it so happens that at the time, interest rates rose as these ARMs came off the freeze of the 2 years, and people couldn't meet their new monthly payments. One in five mortgages across the United States, and particularly in Cleveland, were subprime. And these were popular, as I said, in places like Cleveland, where people were going in and selling them rapidly to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to qualify for a mortgage. And they were also popular in Southern California, Arizona, Nevada, and the suburbs of Washington, D.C., as well as New York City. It's estimated that 2 million people will be evicted from their homes as the foreclosure cases work their way through courts.
Well, Maya, the BBC correctly calls this a subprime crisis, which has gone nationwide. And in the process of examining how it has gone nationwide, it states the property crash is affecting the broader economy. The building industry will cut its output by half, and that will lead to the loss of between 1 and 2 million jobs. And that's 15% of the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy is slowing to a point where there is no longer a growth rate of any substance. And it states the economic slowdown will get worse as the banks and other lenders cut back on credit that they will make available. They are rejecting most people who apply for credit cards, insisting on bigger deposits for house purchases and looking closely at applications for personal loans. There is a drying up of the wholesale bond market, and by the effect of the crisis on their own balance sheets. The banking industry is facing huge losses as a result of the subprime crisis. The bond market has collapsed, suffering huge losses of the bondholders, such as pension funds who bought subprime mortgage bonds. These have fallen sharply in value and are worth 20% of their original value. Do you understand what that means, brothers and sisters? Investments on the part of retirees and pension funds. Millions of people whose life savings are at stake, whose pensions are at risk, whose health care is on the line, investments have been made on their behalf in institutional holdings that are in a state of collapse. It is estimated, the BBC concludes, that ultimately losses suffered by financial institutions will be between $220 billion and $450 billion as the $1 trillion in subprime mortgage bonds is devalued. And here in the Washington Post, Stephen Perlstein, the headline is Public Risk, Private Gain. With the acquiescence of federal regulators, Wall Street went hog wild. It grabbed gobs of money and in the process created a whopping mess the federal government now has to clean up. And that's the context of the Fed's decision to put $30 billion behind the rescue of Bear Stearns. As Nouriel Roubini, the New York University economist who has been predicting this debacle for more than a year, Perlstein writes, quote, "We've mastered the art of socializing risk and privatizing gain. That is the essence of capitalism, brothers and sisters. That's the nature of the dictatorship of capital in our society. That's the meaning of the capture of the state, which is its instrument for subsidizing the capitalist ruling class while pauperizing the mass of our population, exploiting our labor, profiteering over the productive forces that we are able to create. It is a society that is incapable of meeting the elementary needs of the mass of our people, and it is now in a protracted and unavoidable and uncontainable crisis."
Ralph, the BBC prepared a timeline of the subprime crisis. And remember, this is not the first crisis. We had the savings and loan crisis, again, based upon speculative investments in home mortgages, and there have been other crises, many other crises based upon speculation, and we can discuss that in another show. On February 14th, they published this timeline, and it starts with 22nd of February of 2007, when HSBC, one of the major British banks, fires the head of its U.S. mortgage lending business as losses reached $10.5 billion. March 8th, the biggest U.S. house builder, D.R. Horton, warned of huge losses from the subprime fallout. New Century Financial, one of the biggest subprime lenders in the United States, on March 12th, suspended trading in its company because it feared it would head for bankruptcy. Then March 16th, Accredited Home Lenders Holdings said it would sell $2.7 billion of its subprime loan book at a heavy discount in order to generate some cash for its business. On April 2nd, New Century Financial files for Chapter 11 after it's forced by its backers to repurchase billions of dollars of bad loans. Again, this is another home mortgage company. And then UBS, one of the major banks, it has its U.S. subprime lending arm, Dillon Reed Capital. It was closed by UBS on May 3rd, and it goes on from there.
Well, the BBC has performed a real service, brothers and sisters. It delineates literally company by company, collapse by collapse, the nature of this accumulating capitalist debacle. As Maya cites, UBS is seeking a capital plan backing. Union Bank Suisse boss Marcel Ospel told an angry shareholder meeting it is essential that they back a $13 billion Swiss franc overseas capital injection. Singapore's investment arm has bought shares in the bank for almost $10 billion, while an unnamed Middle Eastern investor has taken a stake. And the head of Union Bank Suisse confesses, "We failed to recognize the signals from the U.S. housing market in time. We judged the developments wrongly. I never thought that I would have to relinquish my responsibilities." And he states that the crisis of UBS is total. Rival financial giants, the BBC concludes, including Merrill Lynch, Citibank, and the major European banks, are struggling to repair their balance sheets after their disastrous subprime investments. And the BBC on the 14th, Crédit Agricole hit by subprime. France's biggest retail bank, Crédit Agricole, made a loss in the last 3 months, hit by hefty charges at its Caillon investment banking arm, worse than Crédit Agricole's forecast. It is on the verge of collapse, as is Société Générale, one of the largest banks in Europe that had been a target for takeover by Crédit Agricole, now hit by the subprime crisis. And here in the BBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank in $17 billion credit crisis loss. The UK's largest bank has made a $17.2 billion loss after the decline in the U.S. housing market hit the value of its loans. And again, central banks fight the credit crisis. The world's, this is the BBC again, on the 14th of March, the world's largest central banks have launched their latest coordinated action to calm the jittery credit markets. The U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the central banks in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and Switzerland, seeking to inject billions of dollars to stabilize the money markets. And Evan Davis, the BBC economics editor, states, "It is not that the banks don't have cash to lend, it's that they don't trust each other to have sufficient assets." And again in the BBC, hedge fund on verge of collapse, Carlyle Capital Corporation, a unit of the private equity firm Carlyle Group, will not be able to meet lenders' demands for money. The U.S. mortgage-backed fund will collapse as its lenders seize its remaining assets.
And, Ralph, that was not on subprime mortgages. That was on AAA-rated mortgages. It's just that the banking institutions don't trust anything that has to do with mortgage-backed securities anymore, because as you look through the year, not day by day, but actually if you get a global picture of the year, you see the failure of all these mortgage companies, such as Countrywide, or last August, American Home Mortgage, which is the largest U.S. independent home loan provider. It had filed for bankruptcy after it laid off the majority of its staff. And Countrywide, as I mentioned earlier in the show, was forced to be bought out by Bank of America. Last July, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned that the U.S. subprime lending market would cost the banks up to $100 billion. That would be the write-off. But recently, the economists for the G7 countries, the major industrial countries of the world, they said that the cost, actually, of this speculative housing market was going to be $400 billion worldwide. The ramifications of this we have been discussing during this show. And it's not something that couldn't have been predicted. The World Socialist website, in an article that it published recently, March 18th, "Shades of 1929, Bear Stearns Collapse Signals Deepest Crisis Since the Great Depression," refers to Volume 2 of Karl Marx's seminal work, Capital. And Marx makes the point about banks and financial houses. Quote, "The process of production appears merely as an unavoidable intermediate link, as a necessary evil for the sake of money-making. All nations with a capitalist mode of production are therefore seized periodically by a feverish attempt to make money without the intervention of the process of production," end quote. What Marx is talking about is the development of speculative instruments, such as derivative or these mortgage-backed securities. Ralph?
Well, Maya, here's an article by the Associated Press reporter Aaron C. Davis on March 17th, dated Sacramento, California. "States' budget crises will hurt millions. Financially strapped states are looking to take away government health insurance and benefits from millions of Americans already struggling with a souring economy. An Associated Press review of the budgets in all 50 states reveals coverage will be eliminated for hundreds of thousands of poor children, disabled, and the elderly. Over 10 million people will lose dental care, access to specialists, name-brand prescription drugs, and benefits. 20 million will see their care jeopardized by further cuts to doctors' reimbursements. Health care is a choice target as governors and legislators confront the worst deficits they faced in a decade or more. That's not their only target. They're also considering cuts in aid to schools and universities, shrinking the state workforces, releasing prisoners before their sentences are completed. The safety net programs for the elderly and the disabled and the out of work will be cut, even as the demand for these services is on the rise. Despite dire conditions, only a handful of the states are seriously considering tax increases or modest hikes on the wealthy to close the gaps. Instead, states are looking to increase lottery ticket sales, promote Indian gambling, or raise taxes on cigarettes and alcohol. These taxes disproportionately hit the pocketbooks of the same poor and working class that would be hurt by the spending cuts, the studies show," the article continues. Nearly two dozen states are grappling with deep cuts, tax proposals to close shortfalls totaling over $34 billion. That includes California, where lawmakers have made emergency cuts and authorized billions in bond sales to half a deficit once projected at $16 billion through June 2009. A dozen states are joining, and this article continues, but I want to move on to the following. Big business is even more unpopular than you think, writes Robert Weissman on January 16, 2008. The United States public holds big business in shockingly low regard. A November 2007 Harris poll found that less than 15% of the population of the United States believe that the industries are to be considered honest or trustworthy. Tobacco companies, oil companies, managed care companies, HMOs, health insurance companies, telephone companies, life insurance companies, online retailers, pharmaceutical and drug companies, car manufacturers, airlines, packaged food companies, electric and gas utilities. Only 15% of adults say they trust the best-rated industry about which Harris surveyed in its poll. An amazing 84% told Harris that big companies have too much power in Washington.
Ralph, today is the fifth anniversary of the U.S. assault against Iraq. The shock and awe bombing, and then the U.S.-led invasion. Again, while we're talking about the U.S. bailout of Wall Street and the financial institutions such as Bear Stearns, let us talk about the misappropriation of funds here in the U.S., as well as the death of the Iraqi people, the death of U.S. soldiers. And that is with the $3 trillion war. $3 trillion is estimated by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes of Harvard University. $3 trillion war. So far, according to the Congressional Budget Office, $413 billion has been spent on the war against Iraq.
Maya, 2 million people in Iraq, the blockade and the starvation included, have died. Almost 3 million internal refugees. The country almost entirely radioactive from the use of depleted uranium. And here in the CBS poll of the New York Times poll on January 13th, 75% of the people of the United States state the country is on the wrong track, matching the highest number ever recorded in the CBS New York Times poll. Concern about the direction of the economy, concern about the war in Iraq, concern about the profiteering of the large corporations, concern about the direction of the country. 6 in 10 Americans state they want the war in Iraq ended. This is a population in rising opposition, in resistance and disaffection, in profound alienation, registering the crisis overwhelming them and preparing for the struggles ahead.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital. Visit our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.